I'm Donald Trump. In a world of more than 6 billion people, there are only 587 billionaires. It's an exclusive club. Would you like to join us? Of course, the odds against you are about 10 million to 1. But if you think like a billionaire, those odds shouldn't faze you at all. Billionaires don't care what the odds are. We don't listen to common sense or do what's conventional or expected. We follow our vision, no matter how crazy or idiotic other people think it is. That's what this audiobook is about, learning how to think like a billionaire. Even if you absorb only 10% of the wisdom you're about to hear, you'll still have a good shot at becoming a millionaire. And a millionaire's not so bad, is it? In my previous audiobook, How to Get Rich, I shared some of my favorite techniques for running a profitable business and becoming a TV megastar. Consider this the second part of an ongoing conversation between you and the Donald, the billionaire's equivalent of those best-selling works of inspiration, Conversations with God, and Conversations with God, Book 2. I'm only kidding. Actually, I'm sure some wise guy in the media is going to accuse me of comparing myself to God. So for the record, I definitely do not think I'm God. I believe in God. If God ever wanted an apartment in Trump Tower, I would immediately offer my best luxury suite at a very, very special price. I believe God is everywhere and in all of us, and I want every decision I make to reflect well on me when it's time for me to go to that big boardroom in the sky. When I get permanently fired by the ultimate boss, I want the elevator to heaven to go up, not down. Some of you may think it's wrong to talk about God and business in the same breath, but God has always been central to our way of thinking about capitalism. The Protestant work ethic has thrived for centuries. The pursuit of prosperity is ingrained in our religious culture. The more you have, the more you can give. Here's something else about God that any billionaire knows. He's in the details, and you need to be there, too. I couldn't run a business any other way. When I'm talking to a contractor or examining a site or planning a new development, no detail is too small to consider. I even try to sign as many checks as possible. For me, there's nothing worse than a computer signing checks. When you sign a check yourself, you're seeing what's really going on inside your business. And if people see your signature at the bottom of the check, they know you're watching them, and they screw you less because they have proof that you care about the details. I learned how to think like a billionaire by watching my father, Fred Trump. He was the greatest man I'll ever know and the biggest influence on my life. He was the best.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Trump, Think Like a Billionaire. Everything you need to know about success, real estate, and life. By Donald J. Trump with Meredith McIver. Read by Barry Bostwick with an introduction by the author.
A lot has been written about my family. A writer named Gwenda Blair spent 12 years on her thorough history, The Trumps, three generations that built an empire. She even traced our lineage back to 1608, when a German lawyer named Hans Drumpf settled in the town of Karlstadt, 40 miles west of the Rhine River. According to Blair, one of my ancestors, a wine grower, changed the family name to Trump at the end of the 1600s. A good move, I think, since Drumpf Tower doesn't sound nearly as catchy. My grandfather Friedrich was the first Trump to come to America. Like many entrepreneurs, he ran away from home because he didn't want to work in the family wine business. One of my fellow billionaires, John R. Simplot, left his family farm because he didn't want to spend the rest of his days milking cows. Instead, he became a potato grower and one of the largest suppliers to McDonald's. He earned his billions in French fries. One way to think like a billionaire is to question your surroundings. Don't assume you have to accept the hand you were dealt. My grandfather was a barber and the owner of several businesses, including a hotel and a restaurant. He moved from New York City to Seattle and eventually to Alaska during the gold rush, where he fed miners at the biggest joint in town, the Arctic Restaurant. Unfortunately, he caught pneumonia and died when my father was just a boy. My father never said much to me about him or about other Trump family history. Fred C. Trump wasn't the kind of dad who took us to the movies or played catch with us in Central Park. He was better than those fathers. Instead, he'd take me to his building sites in Brooklyn and Queens. He'd say, "Let's make the rounds," and we'd be on our way. He never yelled at me or had to punish me, but he was always strong and a little remote until I joined his business. That's when I really got to know him. I saw how he dealt with contractors and unions, and how he made the most out of every space. My father believed in adding the extra element to his properties. He was among the first to build garages into homes in Brooklyn. He could be a showman, too. His deals were front-page news in the Brooklyn newspapers. He advertised regularly and had big openings for his developments. His gift for promotion rubbed off on me, but it was never something we talked about. And to this day, I don't think promotion had much to do with either his success or mine. We succeeded because we learned how to create the best buildings at the best locations with the best zoning. My father showed me how to fight the unions and the politicians in order to get the building done under budget and ahead of schedule. And then after the building is up and it's a great success, everyone says, "Boy, Donald, that was a great promotion," when promotion had nothing to do with it. My father always trusted me. He'd been in business for 50 years, but he'd never let anyone else in the company sign his checks until I came to work. He had absolutely no doubt about my ability. His faith gave me unshakable confidence. Even when I was at my lowest in the early 1990s, when the real estate market tanked and I was billions in debt, and Ivana and her lawyers and 100 banks were ready to sue my ass off, my father told me he had absolutely no doubt that my business would be fine. He'd say, "You are a killer. You are a king." My father never wanted to build in Manhattan. He thought it was too expensive. He'd say, "If I can buy a piece of land for $1 a square foot in Brooklyn, why should I pay $1,000 a square foot in Manhattan?" It was a different philosophy, but it worked for him. I'd been working in the family business for 5 years when I made the move into Manhattan. Some critics had suggested that my success is a result of family money, but family money didn't get my first Manhattan projects built. I had to raise tens of millions of dollars from investors for those jobs. It wasn't money that my father gave me. It was knowledge. Knowledge that became instinctive for me. When I was in college, I thought about becoming a movie producer. But whenever I talked to a friend about real estate, he would say, "Why would you want to make movies when you already know so much about real estate?" So, yes, my father was a millionaire many times over. But if he hadn't shown me how to think about business, I never would have made it into the Billionaires Club. I wish I could tell you that the Billionaires Club meets regularly at Mar-a-Lago, where we gather to analyze our portfolios, make blockbuster deals, eat caviar, and drink vintage wine. But the truth is, I don't drink, I'd rather eat a steak than caviar, and I've met only about 20 of the club members over the years, often on the golf course, where we tend to talk more about our game than our net worth. Still, I've studied fellow billionaires from afar, and I've also read what others have written about us. In an article for Forbes by Matthew Herper, Robert Barron, a psychologist at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, said we are persuasive and have strong social skills, that we call upon our charisma to make a sale. In the same article, Kelly Shaver, a professor of psychology at William & Mary College, says we don't care what other people think about us. She said, "They're just happy to go off and do what they're doing." I agree. My father thought I was nuts to build in Manhattan, but I didn't listen to him because I had my own vision. One of my favorite billionaires is Warren Buffett, who has his own vision, too. He didn't follow the stampede into the dot-com gold rush, even though he was widely criticized for remaining a traditional value investor. Now he once again looks like a genius. One of many things I admire about Warren is that in all of his years as CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, he has never sold one share of stock. Another student of successful entrepreneurs, Michael McAbee, a psychoanalyst and consultant, believes that billionaires like Jeff Bezos, Steve Jobs, and Ted Turner are successful in part because they are narcissists who devote their talent with unrelenting focus to achieving their dreams, even if it's sometimes at the expense of those around them. His book, The Productive Narcissist, makes a convincing argument that narcissism can be a useful quality if you're trying to start a business. A narcissist does not hear the naysayers. At the Trump Organization, I listen to people. But my vision is my vision. In The Natural History of the Rich, author Richard Conniff put it this way. Almost all successful alpha personalities display a single-minded determination to impose their vision on the world, an irrational belief in unreasonable goals bordering at times on lunacy. He quotes a passage from Michael Lewis on entrepreneur Jim Clark in The New Thing. He was a guy who always won the game of chicken because his opponent suspected he might actually enjoy a head-on collision. I doubt Jim Clark really would enjoy that collision, but the fact that he has convinced people that he might has a lot to do with his success. Here are my top 10 ways of thinking like a billionaire. Number 1. Don't take vacations. What's the point? If you're not enjoying your work, you're in the wrong job. Even when I'm playing golf, I'm doing business. I never stop, and I'm usually having fun. Now that my kids are joining the family business, I'm closer to them than I've ever been. And I'm finding out that I love relating to them just the way my own father related to me, through a passion for work well done. By the way, I'm not the only one who doesn't take vacations. My NBC compatriot, Jay Leno, works just as much as I do, and maybe that's one of the reasons he stayed on top in the late-night ratings wars. Number 2, have a short attention span. Most successful people have very short attention spans. It has a lot to do with imagination. Quite often, I'll be talking to someone, and I'll know what they're going to say before they say it. After the first 3 words are out of their mouth, I can tell what the next 40 are going to be, so I try to pick up the pace and move it along. You can get more done faster that way. Number 3, don't sleep any more than you have to. I usually sleep about 4 hours per night. I'm in bed by 1 a.m. and up to read the newspapers at 5 a.m. That's all I need, and it gives me a competitive edge. I have friends who are successful and sleep 10 hours a night, and I ask them, how can you compete against people like me if I sleep only 4 hours? It rarely can be done. No matter how brilliant you are, there's not enough time in the day. You may be wondering, why do you need a competitive edge? You don't if you're happy to be an also-ran in life. In A Natural History of the Rich, Richard Conniff notes that it's common behavior for moguls to seek dominance. Even such traits as who makes the most eye contact in a conversation can be an indication of who seeks to dominate. Conniff singles me out as an example of someone who achieves dominance through my appearance, by leaving my eyebrows untrimmed in order to intimidate negotiating partners. I'm pleased to note that he doesn't comment on my hair. Number 4, don't depend on technology. A lot of it is unnecessary and expensive. I don't have a computer on my desk. I don't even use an intercom. When I want someone in my office, I yell. It works a lot better than an intercom, and it's much faster. I don't even have an ATM card. I've never used one in my life. That's the funny thing about being rich. When I go to restaurants, I rarely have to pay. It's usually on the house. The sad part is that if I needed the money, they would make me pay. I can understand why some people would appreciate the convenience of ATM cards, but a lot of other tech devices are completely unnecessary and get in the way of human contact. If you have something important to say, look the person in the eye and say it. And if you can't get there, pick up the phone and make sure they hear the sincerity in your voice. Email is for wimps. Number 5. Think of yourself as a one-man army. You're not only the commander-in-chief, you're the soldier as well. You must plan and execute your plan alone. People are always comparing business to war and to sports. We do it because these are analogies we immediately understand, not because business is about toughness. It isn't. It's much more important to be smart than tough. I know some very bad businessmen who are brutally tough, but they're not smart people. They want to act like Vince Lombardi, but they don't know how to win. Lombardi would slap his players, even spit in their faces. He'd have 300-pound men virtually crying. He could do that because he won, but you can do that only if you win. Billionaires like to win. A Natural History of the Rich is full of examples of hyper-competitive plutocrats. Larry Ellison racing his yacht from Australia to Tasmania. Steve Fawcett flying a balloon around the world, and Dennis Tito paying $20 million for a trip to space on a Russian rocket. All of them, one way or another, were showing off, Conniff writes. To put it in the biological context, they were engaging in display behavior. Animals do it all the time, and their displays, like ours, fall loosely into two categories. They show off with fine feathers, and they show off with risky behavior. I have my own theory, but it's not as scientific. We do it because it's fun. Work hard, play hard, and live to the hilt. Number 6. It's often to your advantage to be underestimated. You never want people to think you're a loser or a schlepper, but it's not a good idea if they think you're the smartest guy in the room either. Because I wrote The Art of the Deal, everyone is always on guard whenever I negotiate with them. One of the reasons President Reagan was such a successful candidate for office was because rival politicians consistently misjudged him. They assumed an actor wouldn't be able to compete. Through years of insults about his lack of intelligence and political experience, Reagan would smile and remain genial, and in the end, he always exceeded expectations. Because I'm too famous to be underestimated, I know that sounds egotistical, but it's true. I'm always impressed by ultra-successful people who live great lives in a low-key manner. For example, one of my neighbors in Trump Tower is a man named Joel Anderson. For years, I'd see him in the elevator and say hello, but I didn't know anything about him. One day, he called my office and said, "Do you think it would be possible for Mr. Trump to attend my party?" He seemed like a nice guy with a terrific wife, so I figured I'd pop in for a few minutes. When I got to the party, I was amazed to find myself surrounded by some of the most influential people in New York, including S.I. Newhouse and Anna Wintour. I soon discovered that mild-mannered Joel Anderson is the chairman and CEO of Anderson News, one of the country's largest distributors of newspapers and magazines. He's one of the most powerful and generous people I know. I'd been riding in the elevator with him for years, and I never knew who he was. In How to Get Rich, I discussed how important it is to let people know about your accomplishments. I'll always believe that, but there are times when it's even more impressive if people discover your accomplishments without you telling them directly. A few weeks after Joel Anderson's party, I noticed a long and highly positive profile of him in the business section of the New York Times. So I want to amend my advice from the previous book. It's often necessary to boast, but it's even better if others do it for you. Number 7. Success breeds success. The best way to impress people is through results. It's easier for me to do deals now because I've had so many triumphs. You have to create success to impress people in the world of business. If you're young and you haven't had any successes yet, then you have to create the impression of success. It doesn't matter whether the success is a small one or a big one. You have to start with something and build on it. Number 8. Friends are good, but family is better. It's better to trust your family than your friends. When I was young, I said to someone who had a fairly big business, "Do you see your brothers and sisters?" The person looked at me and said, "Yes, I do, Donald. I see them in court." That had a big impact on me, and I've always tried to stay close to my brothers and sisters, my children, and my former wives. Number 9. Treat each decision like a lover. Vast fortunes are accumulated through dozens of decisions a day, thousands a month, and hundreds of thousands in a career. Yet each decision is different and special in its own way. Sometimes you decide immediately, love at first sight. Sometimes you go slowly, the long engagement. Sometimes you gather people in a room and consider various opinions, the equivalent of asking your friends what they think of the person you've been dating. If you treat each decision like a lover, faithfully, respectfully, appropriately, you won't be locked into a rigid system. You'll adapt to the needs of that particular decision. Sometimes you'll think with your head. Other times, you'll think with other parts of your body. And that's good. Some of the best business decisions are made out of passion. People are sometimes surprised by how quickly I make big decisions, but I've learned to trust my instincts and not to overthink things. I like to compare a decision to a lover because it reminds me to keep in touch with my basic impulses, the drives that excite us, attract us, give us inspiration and energy. We are all drawn to beauty, whether it's the allure of a person or the elegance of a home. Whenever I'm making a creative choice, I try to step back and remember my first shallow reaction. The day I realized it's sometimes smart to be shallow was, for me, a deep experience. Number 10. Be curious. A successful person is always going to be curious. I don't know why this is true, but it's always the case. You have to be alive to your surroundings and hungry to understand your immediate world. Otherwise, you'll lack the perspective to see beyond yourself. One of the great aspects of working on The Apprentice has been learning about how network TV works. I recently found out that one of the reasons Thursday nights are so crucial to the networks is because that's when lucrative movie advertisements for the weekend releases are aired. The higher the ratings are on Thursday night, the more the networks can charge their advertisers. And the more they can charge their advertisers, the more they can pay me to save their network. You see? Curiosity pays. I'll offer a lot more advice on how to think like a billionaire in the rest of this audiobook. For the first time, I'm sharing practical advice on how to invest in real estate, buying, selling, getting a mortgage, dealing with a broker, renovating and decorating. I've also put together a consumer guide to the best things in life. You don't have to be a billionaire to afford them either. Whenever I give speeches or appear in public, people want to hear about The Apprentice. So I'll take you behind the scenes of the first two seasons and describe what it's like to go from prime locations to prime time. I'll never forget what a thrill the first season's live finale was. We were about to switch from the taped part of the show to the live conclusion, where, without a script, I would spontaneously announce whether I was hiring Kwame or Bill. Right before I went on the air, the brilliant head of NBC, Jeff Zucker, told me he was already receiving instant reports that the audience watching our program was going to be huge. That's not exactly what I needed to hear before appearing on live national television, but it turned out to be a truly exhilarating experience. People have been referring to The Apprentice as a comeback for me, but I never went away. I was always big, and my buildings just keep getting bigger and better. And if you personally are bigger than ever, I've added another new element to this book, The Mar-a-Lago Diet, a brief guide to the eating habits of billionaires and the people who lunch with them. I'm a frequent follower of the Mar-a-Lago diet, and even though I'm not going to be considered thin, without this diet, I'd look and feel like a total disaster. So prepare yourself. You're about to hear the only book I'll ever write that will make you rich and thin. Perhaps one day you'll join the Billionaires Club. I'm sure I'll enjoy your company. Part 1. Real Estate. When people hear the name Trump, they think of two things, wealth and real estate. So while this entire audiobook's dedicated to the creation and enjoyment of wealth, I need to start with the basics. The basics for me are all about property. Real estate is at the core of almost every business, and it's certainly at the core of most people's wealth. In order to build your wealth and improve your business smarts, you need to know about real estate. What follows is some great advice. There are some helpful tips here for first-time apartment renters as well as for multiple home owners. So, listen closely. How to pick a location. I hate the phrase location, location, location because I've seen a lot of idiots ruin good locations and a lot of geniuses make incredible investments out of horrible locations. You could hand over the location for Trump Tower, by far the best location in New York City, and a moron could run the site into the ground. I guarantee it. But when it comes to your home, you should always pick a good spot. Spending more on a good location is far smarter than getting a bargain in a bad area. Is it close to work? Is the neighborhood safe? Or will you fear for your life as you come and go? Is it close to conveniences such as restaurants, grocery stores, shops, and banks? Do you feel like you belong in the neighborhood? Or do you feel out of place? I'm the first to admit that location should be considered seriously when investing in real estate. A lot of picking a location comes down to instinct. You have to believe in the location. Otherwise, you'll be making a rotten investment. Be honest with yourself about the location's proximity to the rest of your life. If you find an apartment or a house or an office that you like that puts hours of additional travel into your day or requires expensive deliveries and services or prevents people from visiting you, you might as well find somewhere else. I realize that not everyone can live and work in Trump Tower, which certainly works for me, but given the choice, you should find the location that works best for you. Walk around the neighborhood. Spend time there. What's the pattern of the day? When does the neighborhood wake up and when does it go to bed? What sort of people are living there and working there? Also, make sure to check out the neighborhood on the weekends. Some neighborhoods in Manhattan are insanely busy all week and then dead all weekend, and vice versa. What happens if you move into an apartment and realize that there's a nightclub across the street blasting music each and every night, or the garbage trucks congregate there after making the rounds in the early morning? You'll either go crazy or move out, neither of which are good options. The view is important. I don't know anyone who wants to spend their life looking into an air shaft or a brick wall. If you have the option, go for the view. But you have to be careful with a view, particularly if you're paying for it. The current view might look out over a parking facility or an empty lot, but that could change in a week. In cities like New York, buildings seem to be going up at the rate of one per day, so make sure you have a good idea that the view that's there today will be there tomorrow. When you're speculating or investing in real estate that will not necessarily serve as your primary home or office, I often recommend finding space in a marginal neighborhood, buying or renting at a lower price, and then waiting for the neighborhood to improve. You'll save in taxes, make a meaningful contribution to the redevelopment of that area, and stand to make more money in the long run. If you have the time, the patience, and the fortitude, I recommend it. After all, when I bought up the West Side Yards, people thought I was insane, but I proved them wrong, as my development there can attest. Today, that area is one of the most desirable and valuable areas in all of Manhattan. How to rent an apartment. A lot of people don't take renting an apartment as seriously as they should. I don't understand those people. While renting an apartment is not buying, the place will serve as your home and should be considered carefully. Not only is your home a big part of the way you feel about yourself, it's also a reflection of how others see you. Billionaires, even those who rent their homes, take time when finding places to live, and so should you. In New York City, an apartment market I know all too well, people often feel lucky to find anything. There's enormous demand, and sometimes hundreds of people will charge through the streets to look at exorbitantly expensive shoeboxes that they all saw listed in the New York Times. Most of these people will be prepared with letters of reference, with bank statements, credit card bills, and with a sense of competition that can be fierce. To play in this apartment market, or any other real estate market, you have to have done your homework. Have a clear idea of your financial needs and your living requirements. Going blindly from apartment to apartment will be a waste of everyone's time, particularly your own. I feel strongly that an apartment should be rented with the help of a good broker. It can be done without one, but to me, that's like taking pills without consulting a doctor or filing a lawsuit without a lawyer. It's possible, but it's stupid. Brokers know the neighborhoods and the specific markets inside and out. They know property values, the pros and cons of certain buildings, the rules and regulations of pricing and rents, and the ins and outs of the actual lease. Brokers are educated and licensed, and there's good reason for that. They will prevent you from making mistakes that will cost you thousands, and in my case, millions, more than the fees that they charge. They will also save you time by filtering out apartments that do not meet your criteria. But you should never believe everything a broker tells you. The broker is, after all, only there for the commission, as concerned and as accommodating as he or she may seem. And when it comes to the commission, whether you're selling, buying, or renting, always negotiate. Sometimes brokers do an amazing job and deserve a high commission, but when you enter the relationship, always negotiate from the start. It's much easier to negotiate the fee at the beginning of a broker relationship. Trying to lowball brokers midway through or at the end of a transaction is poor business form. If you cannot afford a broker or simply want to go it alone, look in the papers or on bulletin boards. Ask around and walk around. Some of the best New York stories I've heard are about finding apartments that simply came out of nowhere. Kind of like those stories about getting a taxi in the pouring rain on New Year's Eve. It can happen, but the odds are lousy. In When Harry Met Sally, Billy Crystal reads through the obituary so he can move in on the apartments of the recently deceased. If you want to go without a broker, maybe try that approach, as morbid as it might be. Whether or not you use a broker, find somewhere where you'll be happy for a long time. Moving around every couple of years is disruptive and expensive. And most important, figure out what you can afford. It's not a concern for me, but I would never spend more than 25% of my salary on rent, no matter how fantastic an apartment you have found. Every dollar you pour into rent is a dollar you could be using elsewhere, whether it's for savings or for utilities or for enjoying the finer things in life. It's okay to stretch yourself slightly and anticipate that in a few years you may be making more money, but that's not a sure thing. And it's a safe assumption that your rent will increase at the same rate as your salary. Tenants who cannot pay their rent will go nowhere fast, and certainly never make it into the Billionaires Club. How to read a classified ad or listing. Often people resort to the classified ads or other listings to find apartments and houses for rent. Don't be a fool. In New York, in particular, advertisers will make rat-infested closets sound like the penthouse of Trump Tower. Learn to see through the garbage in the advertisements so you don't waste time looking at apartments that should be bulldozed rather than inhabited. The advertisers should all write novels since they're clearly so talented at writing fiction. Pay attention to the words like funky and charming, which you can translate as unlivable and run down. Ads that brag newly renovated usually mean that the landlord has simply slapped new knobs on the bathroom cabinets. Other phrases that should make you nervous include old world appeal, read dilapidated, cozy, read tiny, and freshly painted, read there's nothing good to say about the apartment except that it has a fresh coat of paint. Anything that sounds too good to be true is, especially when it comes to apartments. Also, pay attention to the information that's not provided. If there's no apartment number provided, you can bet it's on the first floor, where it's never good to live because of crime and noise. And if there's no square footage provided, it's too embarrassing for the advertiser to mention. Also, if there's no photograph, beware. Even the worst apartments can be made to look palatial on film, so you should be doubly suspicious if a photograph is missing when other apartments in the ad include one. Houses, apartments, and offices need to be touched and seen before you rent or buy them. Classified ads and listings can point you in the right direction, but it's your responsibility to thoroughly investigate any property you may be considering. How to buy a house. The real estate market can be terrifying, which is part of the reason I love it so much. But it can be downright petrifying when it involves what may be your most valuable possession, your home. The market changes every day, sometimes every minute. For home buyers, some of whom will buy one house in a lifetime, trying to time the market perfectly can be a ridiculous waste of time. In 10, 20, or 40 years, any small variations in the price of your house will have amortized into a blip on your financial radar screen. You have to go with your gut. And if you love a house and you can afford it and your broker assures you that you're paying a fair market price, you're paying the best price. It's as simple as that. When it comes to your home, don't be concerned about spending more than it's worth if you know that you will be there forever and you'll be happy there. Sometimes the emotional price you put on a house may exceed the market price. Buying a home is different from the pure economics of investing in real estate. If you simply cannot afford a house that you love, don't be shy about underbidding. Sometimes the seller will surprise you. Before you start looking for a house or even figuring out what you can afford to buy, make sure you have money socked away. Brokers and sellers will take you seriously, and you will increase your bargaining power as you're able to increase the size of your down payment. Buying a house is a serious investment, and banks and lenders will be there to help you make that investment. A typical home buyer will not have access to 100% financing, and you have to be as invested as your lender. The down payment should be your own personal gauge for your commitment to the house. Don't lose sight of the checks and balances, because ultimately it will all come down to your checks and balances. While it's good to be mindful of costs when buying a house, don't go overboard. Don't try to save money on necessary items, such as not getting a survey where it might be of value, or relying on people who are not well recommended or not known. Do not attempt to save small amounts of money on items that are important parts of the process. People often stupidly try to save money at a real estate closing, since some adjustments will probably still be made and the negotiations will not have ended. But don't be hard-headed and cheap when it comes to buying a house. It's counterproductive. Simply put aside some money before you begin the house buying process. Call it your reserve budget, and then legal and financial situations that arise will not be skipped to cut costs. Undermining the purchase of your home from the beginning will only end up haunting you down the line. How to get an appraisal and a building inspection. Let's say you find your dream home, a perfect location, perfect architecture, perfect price. Be careful. Always know what you're mortgaging. Don't let your guts trick your brain, and don't rush yourself or allow your broker, who will always be telling you about the other buyers, to rush you either. It is better to have researched the opportunity and lose it than to make a mistake by jumping into something you'll come to regret. The best reality check is the appraisal. The lender will have an appraiser, and in most situations, you will be responsible for paying for the appraisal. The appraisal should not be seen as an annoying expense that will only benefit the lender. The appraisal benefits you as well. Appraisers are professionals, and they will be able to see things that may elude the eye of most home buyers. Ask questions and do your own homework, but at the end of the day, defer to your appraiser. Some of his or her findings might be insulting or surprising, and the truth can hurt, but the appraiser's job is to be objective. A fair appraisal will only help you in the end. Any number of things, some of which are regulated by the government, such as flood control, can affect the location. Other factors, such as proximity to high-tension wires, may or may not be so apparent. You're probably not going to wind up buying the Amityville Horror, but you shouldn't expect that every seller will tell you everything unfavorable about the property to be sold. You're better off assuming that some things will not be divulged out of ignorance, forgetfulness, or evasion. If you're confused by what I'm telling you, rent the movie The Money Pit to familiarize yourself with the pains of ignoring or foregoing the appraisal. In the event that a structure is being purchased with mortgage funds, most probably you should also have a building inspector examine the premises. A building inspection is often required, but you should always require it for yourself. A knowledgeable licensed inspector engineer can detect whether the heating unit is functioning properly, whether the air conditioning is sufficient, whether a sump pump is needed, and so on. Think of a building inspection as an X-ray. The inspector will be able to see through the entire house and identify any systemic problems. For instance, what sort of materials were used for a house's piping? Galvanized, brass, copper, synthetic? Galvanized pipes rust and don't last as long as brass pipes, which don't last as long as copper pipes, which don't last as long as synthetic pipes. Only a building inspector will be able to see this level of detail within a house or apartment. If the inspector makes you nervous or you sense that he or she is working too quickly, find someone else. The inspection is too important to be careless about it. Sometimes the problems inspectors find are fixable at a reasonable cost, but sometimes they find things that cannot be fixed without major renovations or even a teardown. The inspector will provide an objective, independent report that may or may not affect the value of the home, but either way, you can request price adjustments based on the inspection. Another quick tip. Some investors make the dumb mistake of assuming that new constructions do not require building inspections. Wrong. New constructions often have the largest problems, particularly if the build-out and contracting were sloppy. In addition to structural, plumbing, and electrical woes, new constructions can be vexed by mold infestation and other problems typically associated with longer-standing buildings. How to sell a house. If you're selling your home and there is no or little activity, or activity but no offers, you should revisit the price. The real estate market is volatile and prices change daily. I always keep the saying, old listings like old soldiers never die, they just fade away in mind when it comes to pricing. Also, don't worry about competition. Count on it. You will save yourself a lot of time. Competition may even help you by drawing in prospective buyers within the same market. If you know your property is valuable, remain patient. As long as you're realistic about your property's value, there will always be a buyer eventually. Mar-a-Lago was sitting there a long time before I saw it and decided to move on that magnificent site. I had the right vision for it, and the timing was right for me, and ultimately for the seller as well. Just make sure what you have to offer is the best, and you need not worry. If you have a broker, make sure he or she understands what the value of the property is to you. But don't be too bullheaded if your broker thinks the property is worth far less than you do. The broker should be the expert, and you're paying him or her not only for service, but for advice. Your broker, if he or she is good at the job, will strategically advertise the property's sale. A lot of interest is not necessarily always a good thing. Be wary of a broker who fails to screen applicants and lets the whole world traipse through your house. Good brokers will screen applicants for pre-qualification, negotiate on your behalf for the best price, and facilitate the legal and financial processes. You will be paying the broker a substantial fee, usually on the order of 6% and sometimes higher, so he or she is working for you and should be working hard for that commission. Some people try to sell houses without brokers. Not a strategy I would recommend. But if you're feeling up to it, by all means, be my guest. If you want to be your own broker, then the best piece of advice I have is act like a broker. To do so will require a lot of guts, a lot of brains, and a lot of patience. An article by Lindley Browning entitled The Sweet and Sour of For Sale by Owner in the June 6, 2004 edition of the New York Times made it clear just how difficult, but also how money-saving, selling your own home can be. You should find her article and maybe pick up some books to help you along the way. You will have to educate yourself on title searches, legal forms, and the pricing market. You will also have to learn your state's disclosure laws to avoid being sued if the ceiling caves in or mold takes over after you have left. It all sounds like a headache to me, which is why I've always recommended using a broker. How to find a good office. Location is probably the most important concern when it comes to finding a good office. Traveling for meetings, delivering goods and services, and attracting customers and clients can be a hassle if you have a poor location. You, your customers, and your employees have to be happy and productive in that space, and cutting costs and choosing poor office space is a fast way to kill your business. Think about the space you will need, hopefully with enough room for some expansion without requiring you to move within the too near future. If you can find raw space on the fringe of your desired location, this strategy could prove lucrative to you in the future. It may require more upfront time and planning on your part, but it can have enormous financial and professional benefits. Being ahead of the pack is the best place to be. It's also important that you find an office in a building that's well-maintained and well-run. Is the landlord notorious for not fixing the heat? Are the elevators operating efficiently and the bathrooms cleaned regularly? No one I know wants to spend time in an office, either working there or just doing business there, that's unattractive, uncomfortable, and inhospitable. Where you work and what the space looks like is just as important as where you live, if not more. Give it the same thought, and you will be thankful you did. I've been in the same offices at Trump Tower for over 20 years. The location and the space work as beautifully today as they did 20 years ago. It's not dumb luck, though. I knew exactly where I would be today 20 years ago. How to deal with a broker. Why have a novice try to understand the value of a great piece of art? Choose your broker as you would an art dealer, which is judiciously. And as with many things, timing is crucial to success. Stay on top of things and make sure you and your broker are honest with each other at each step in the process. A good broker will listen and respond to your concerns. If the broker takes days to return your phone calls or runs late to meetings, borrow my line and simply say, "You're fired." There are countless other brokers who deserve your business. You're the customer, after all. The best brokers know that whatever is good for you will be good for them. They only make money when you finally make a transaction, so the smart ones won't waste time trying to sell or rent something just for the sake of a commission. My advice is to find a reputable, established broker who has shown a substantial growth index over a number of years in the area in which you desire to live. As in all matters of life, brokers specialize. Why waste time with a broker who only knows high-end retail real estate when you're looking for an affordable one-bedroom apartment? The best brokers are psychologists, or at least they are incredibly insightful. It's their job to figure out what's best for you, but in order for you to help them figure what is best for you, you have to be upfront and honest with them. Don't be embarrassed about telling them that you can't afford something or that you don't like a particular space. Experienced brokers tell me they can usually sense the people who are serious by their first two questions, and they are tip-offs on how to proceed. Don't ever follow the advice of a broker who is pushy. That should be the indication for you to become wary. It isn't necessary for them to behave that way, and if they do, they are best left alone. I know some terrific brokers who are low-key, sincere, and genuinely interested in your well-being. Susan James, who runs the sales office at Trump International Hotel and Tower, is one of the most elegant people you will ever meet, and her elegance isn't an act to get her into your good graces. She remains friends with her clients for many years after they are happily ensconced in their apartments. She is clear about what she is presenting to you before, during, and after. That's the mark of a great broker. Find a great broker, and your chances of finding or selling the right place at the right price will be improved by about 100%. The fee you pay will be one of the best investments you ever make. How to hire an attorney. In some areas, attorneys are not ordinarily involved in real estate closings. In other areas, they absolutely need to be involved. If the cost is reasonable, hire one, even if the situation seems simple. I never, ever sign a contract without consulting with an attorney, and I work with contracts all day long. Real property can involve complicated legal concepts, some of which date back to feudalism. If you feel that the situation is simple and you cannot afford to pay standard rates, most attorneys will negotiate their fees. And if the situation turns complicated and a larger fee materializes, you shouldn't complain. You should consider yourself lucky, since you have probably avoided some problems not otherwise foreseen. How do you get a good attorney if you do not already know one you can trust? Call any bar association, as they usually have referral services. Do not ask your mortgage broker to refer an attorney. Though brokers always know many attorneys, there can be a built-in conflict of interest if the sale should deserve to be aborted. The lawyer might be reluctant to recommend terminating the deal, since the person who recommended him or her will then lose a commission. You're better off getting an independent recommendation for a lawyer who practices primarily in the area of the kind of real estate in discussion, someone who has a good reputation in the eyes of people you know and trust. How to get the best mortgage. Even billionaires need to borrow money now and then, and I've learned a lot about mortgages over the years. The first step, obviously, is to know what you're mortgaging. I know that sounds obvious, but it's amazing to me how often people will seek a mortgage for something they clearly don't know the value of. Numerous books have been written on how to get the best mortgage. Much of the advice is good, and much of it is common sense, and much of it is never properly acted upon. You can probably find a dozen books in your public library on mortgages, but what you really need to understand is how officers at banks and insurance companies think about loans, property, and you. Lenders can often make the most money off of idiots, so be sure to educate yourself before you see them. Like buying a property, applying for a mortgage works best when you have options. Shop around, ask questions, and always bargain. There are countless choices in the mortgage market. The trick is finding the mortgage that works best for you, for your bank account, for your salary, and for your future plans. A mortgage is a product, like the house or the car that you're buying with it, so you should know its ins and outs before purchasing it. Drive a hard bargain, and don't be afraid to walk away. Loan officers can be schizophrenic, offering different rates and deals from one minute to the next. Never, ever accept a first offer, and always ask for better terms. Negotiate or be eaten alive. If you receive a better deal from lender A, always go back to lender B and see if they can match it. After all, each lender is peddling the same product, money, so it doesn't matter where it's coming from. Mortgages are designed to be haggled over, and not to do so is the equivalent of burning money in the street. If you are buying or mortgaging a house or a multifamily dwelling, you have to know what the financials are. Certainly the mortgage company will have to know. Here are some recommendations. Number one, seek accounting advice. Your lawyer and mortgage broker can be of help too. Number two, know the tax history of the property and also any foreseeable tax hikes. Good indicators of an impending tax increase include the need for a new school, a pending reassessment, a busted sewage system, or unpaid liabilities. Once you have taken on the burden of a mortgage, The last thing you'll need is a huge tax bill. Number three, look for hidden costs. There always are some, and they can sink you if you're not careful. Sound, comprehensive cost analysis is crucial. For instance, what if the building cannot be insured at ordinary rates? How do costs for heating, water, and extermination change throughout the year? Try to anticipate any scenarios that will put you in the thick of financial jeopardy. At the end of the day, your mortgage company will want to know what you know. The mortgage company is there to help you. If the mortgage company isn't happy with a certain situation attached to the property, you should not be happy with it either. Most likely, they have more experience than you and have seen other properties turn into nightmares once mortgaged. Also remember that mortgage companies often sell their mortgages to other corporations, banks, insurance companies, or Fannie Mae. The people who are dealing with you initially may not be the same people you will be sending your monthly check to. For that matter, you may very well get notices to send your monthly check to different parties over a number of years. Ordinarily, you will be personally responsible for any home mortgage, and there's a good chance that you will be required to place a personal guarantee on any investment mortgages. If you guarantee a mortgage, you could find yourself paying on a guarantee, even if you have prepared yourself thoroughly. Guarantees can be called upon due to the ups and downs of the market, weather-related catastrophes, and all sorts of insurance-related issues. The subject of title insurance, which you should have to protect yourself against such frauds as forgery in a previous deed and other malfeasance, is also one you should discuss carefully with your attorney. Don't get caught unaware. Real estate can afford great opportunities through mortgaging, leverage, and possibly even absentee management, but don't bet on it. Like anything else, it requires caution, devotion, hard work, and some luck. In truth, there is nothing complicated about mortgaging properties, but care and study are required. Anyone who has seen those commercials on TV in the middle of the night where individuals claim to have retired to Hawaii on the basis of real estate purchased, sold, or rented should realize that the people who sell these courses make more money from selling the courses than they do from selling any real estate or mortgaging. Those infomercials never tell you about the mountain of problems that can be associated with the ownership of real estate. How to pick a mortgage broker. A good way to get a mortgage is to pass the buck to somebody else. Shopping around and comparing mortgages can be time-consuming, so it may save you time to pay someone to do your shopping for you. Get a mortgage broker, but get a good one. These people are engaged daily in the world of mortgages, which means that they have to know where to get the best rates, who is offering the best conditions, and generally, where it's advantageous to apply. In the long run, you will probably pay less for everything if you get a good mortgage broker, since the broker will know what kind of hidden charges there are and steer you clear of various problems. Not only that, but mortgage companies want to keep in the good graces of anyone who's in the habit of referring business to them. There are certainly technical considerations such as the length of the mortgage, whether guarantees are involved, conditions of default, and all kinds of other things that a mortgage broker and a good attorney will inform you about. Ask your real estate broker to recommend a mortgage broker, or ask for a referral from friends, colleagues, and neighbors who have recently taken on mortgages. Like your real estate broker or your attorney, the mortgage broker should be someone you feel comfortable working with, and someone you know will not sideline your best interests in favor of his or her own financial considerations. How to pick an interest rate and down payment. Interest rates are not the mystery they're cracked up to be, but before you get into any real estate venture, you must educate yourself about them. I always think of interest rates simply as the cost of money. The interest rate is like a yearly membership fee or utility bill. It's the amount you're paying to use the mortgage per year. It's like a golf membership to an exclusive club, where you're the only one with the keys to the clubhouse. You should note that some institutions will try to trick you with adjustable interest rates so that your fees will bounce around depending on the economy. If you're adverse to change and want to minimize your risk, I would recommend working with fixed rates. Interest rates have been sagging for the last 20-odd years, and there's good reason to believe that they will only be going up in the short term. Mortgage holders with adjustable rates may be forced to foreclose if the payments become too big. If this setup scares you, and it should, lock in a rate that you know you'll be able to afford for the length of the mortgage. When choosing an actual rate, if the rate is too good to be true, beware. Rates, truth be told, should actually not be the most important consideration, though certainly they need to be considered. To get the best rate today, there are all kinds of services and information available that can tell you what the various banks are charging. The internet has exploded with information, but be careful, as not all of it is accurate. Newspapers often chart interest rates as well. If you get a rate that is much lower than what is out there on the market, you might be looking for trouble. The company might not be around by the time you want to close a mortgage, or you might be charged outrageous fees for a closing. For any mortgage, the lender will always charge assorted fees, and it's wise to make sure you're not getting taken for a ride. A good rule to remember: the lower the interest rate, the higher the possible fees. Read the fine print. Look for a low rate, but remember that the lowest rate may end up costing you the most. When it comes to a down payment, it should be determined in large part by your budget. A lower down payment will result in higher mortgage payments, and vice versa. Depending on where you live, the down payment will hover around 20% of the total loan. In New York City, where the competition for real estate is fierce, the percentages tend to be a lot higher. If you're a good negotiator and want to free up as much of your money as possible, you should try to get as low a down payment as possible. How and when to renovate. If you're going to mortgage a property that you already own, make sure that it is in good condition. For a multifamily building, attention should be given to all kinds of things, such as the condition of the roof, stairways, elevators, storage areas, boiler room, and everything else. Suffice it to say, if the building is not in good condition, an experienced mortgage officer is not going to want to lend money on it. Nor will a bank loan you money on a structure if they do not believe you are going to preserve and protect their collateral. Why should they? If you're about to mortgage your property, you should never make repairs just for cosmetic purposes. Make good, solid repairs and then sell the property or mortgage it for a lot more money. Fix a kitchen, redo the bathroom, put on a fresh coat of paint. My father used to say that every property ought to be sold in mint condition. He said it to me all the time. We all know what it means, and it's some of the best advice he ever gave me. After all, a $15 can of paint can add $1,000 to the value of your property. $1,000 in landscaping can add $10,000, and $10,000 in remodeling can add $100,000. You get the idea. In addition to renovating before selling a property, you may choose to renovate after buying or over the years while you're living or working somewhere to make the space more livable or workable. Renovation equals devotion. It can be expensive and time-consuming, so it's crucial that you figure out whether or not renovations will be worthwhile before committing to them. Renovation is worth it only if your heart and your checkbook are in it. If they're not, it will turn out to be one enormous hassle after another. After all, renovating can often be more difficult than building from scratch. I have always found that the trickiest part of renovations is matching the original ingredients, which isn't always easy. Sometimes just finding them can require a lot of investigative work. I have an employee at Mar-a-Lago who spends his whole week every week just keeping up with the tile work on the premises. There are something like 36,000 Spanish tiles at Mar-a-Lago, most of which date back to the 15th century. I know it may sound ridiculous, but the tiles alone require this kind of attention. And so they get it. You can't just let an investment like that deteriorate. Be prepared for this kind of devotion when you begin serious renovations. The Mar-a-Lago Club is a classic example of smart renovation. In addition to historic merit and exquisite beauty, Mar-a-Lago has been a phenomenal investment, made even more priceless by the hard work that my staff and I have devoted to it. It's more than real estate or an investment. It's a piece of art that requires endless, painstaking work. Work that's not only financially rewarding, but somehow spiritually uplifting as well. I make sure everything done there is top-notch, because Mar-a-Lago is up there with Venetian palaces in terms of craftsmanship and beauty. It deserves the best. The ceiling, the flooring, the walls, the chandeliers, the mirrors.